Beyond what people say, what their voices sound like matters. Voice, as Ana Maria Ochoa Gattier argues, was embedded in 19th century conversations and debates about the boundaries between nature and culture, between the civilized and barbaric, between inclusion or marginalization in a public civic sphere. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, co-host of the New Books in Latin American Studies Network, and I've just spoken with Ana Maria about her marvelous new book, Orality, which, set in Colombia but relevant for much of Latin America and the Caribbean, draws on brilliant interpretations of the sonorous written archive to take up these questions of sound, inscription, and the epistemological and ontological status of voice. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Good morning, Ana. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So can we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be at Columbia University, and just a little bit about how you came to the project?
I came to Columbia University through, the usual process, an application for a job, and got hired as part of the ethnomusicology faculty first in 2003 and then again in 2008. And it's been a place where I've been able to cultivate my interests. I've had a lot of space to do that, and that's been a very important thing for me.
So in the book's opening, you talk about the ways that your original question about the 20th century music fell away with the discovery of what you call a sonorous written archive in the 19th century. Could you talk a little bit about that process of finding out what the book was really about?
Yes. Well, initially, the book project began with an interest on trying to think how, let's say, the intellectual history and trajectory of Latin American musical thought, which I didn't want to subsume under ethnomusicology. And I noticed that if you, go over figures such as, Mario de Andrade, Alejo Carpentier, García Márquez, many others. In Latin America, there's a close relationship between a history of interest in the local, the literary, and the musicological. So the book began with trying to trace the formation of that form of musical knowledge in Colombia itself. But then I was going to do one chapter on the 19th century and found an archive, basically on the bogas of the Magdalena River, on the boat rowers of the Magdalena River, that really turned the whole project around. And it ended up being a project about listening and voice in the 19th century. So it still keeps part of the initial project, but more than a project about intellectual history, it's more about the relationship between listening, voice, and how those two practices were central to the creation of the categories of nature and culture as, fundamental ontological categories of the 19th century. Political landscape in Latin America and the Caribbean.
I think the ways that the key elements run through all of the chapters really are concerned with this division that you talk about between nature and culture, and between human and the non-human, and between noise and sound. And the voice is really central to all of those. In some ways, it mediates among all of those. And so do you think that you could tell us a little bit more about how you conceive of voice and how you used it in the book?
Yes. I think the problem of voice appears very differently in each chapter. What each chapter explores is how did those writers, because they're inscribing what they hear on the technology of writing. It's the mode of interest of registering. So what I explore in each chapter is how do they conceive a voice? And in the way that they conceive of voice, so rather than a general definition, I'm looking for the conceptualizations of voice that emerge from what they hear. And what comes out very strongly is that, the 19th century is the moment of independence or political redefinition of Latin American countries very strongly. A very strong post-colonial moment in a certain way, even though we know by decolonial theory that it's that the colony doesn't end there and at all. But so part of what I'm exploring is how, in any case, because there were emerging nations, they needed to redefine the notion of personhood and the notion of space in the nation. And listening to both what they call, what they name as voices of peoples and different forms of how they end up categorizing people, as well as non-humans of different sorts, end up generating, being used, how they heard voices end up being used to, let's say, establish the political community of persons. So in a way, a project about intellectual history turned up into a project about the definition of the boundary between the human and non-human through listening practices to whatever they called voices. I, at one point, omitted other types of sounds. For example, there's a lot of description of musical instruments. And it was just already, if I had continued with the idea of voice, it was a huge archive. And there's much more about voice, by the way. So I just needed to frame the book somewhere, and voice became one of the framing mechanisms.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And you mentioned the Bogas earlier, and I want to get back to them because I thought that they were among the most interesting of many interesting characters in your book. The book opens with the scenes of 19th century scientific expeditions, and in particular Humboldt and his descriptions of the Bogas, which you quote at length, which are really quite amazing. And the Bogas, you can tell us a little bit more about them, but they basically paddled the canoes of these expeditions, right? And so in the descriptions, you talk about Humboldt, and I love this phrase, about the ways he overcame his acoustic disgust, right? Or at least he was trying to when he talked about the sounds that they make. And so my sense is that you use Humboldt to think about that space that you talk about between the voice and the ears, right? So there's what happens in the voice, and then there's also what happens in the ears of the people who are hearing those sounds. And I was wondering why it's important to you to theorize that space between the voice and the ears.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the elements of the book is exploring this, let's say, colonial setting, in which it's not just trying to define how a local music sounds. But let's say there's two listening practices. For example, let's take the champan, which is the boat that the Bogas rode. So there's two listening practices intersecting here. The way the passengers, which were usually Creole, or European, were listening to them, and the way the Bogas were listening to themselves and in turn to their passengers and to people and to the, let's say, plants and animals that surround them. So when I initially found that passage by Humboldt, I was absolutely fascinated, partially because Humboldt is a fantastic writer. Many others have noted how deeply sensorial his writing is. And so what I did is I stopped the research on the 20th century book and started reading tremel writing down the Magdalena River. And I found many other quotes of Bogas sounding, and I compared them. For the book, I chose about 8, but I compared about 20 quotes and all, and began to find a series of consistencies in modes of description. So Humboldt is a starting point, yet at the same time, at the end of that chapter, and in another part of the book, I also spend some time with his own mode of theorizing sounds in nature. The Bogas became key figures, not only because of they were key 19th century players. You find them everywhere. They appear especially in that first chapter. They appear again under the penmanship of Candelario Obeso. And then they appear again in La Maria and Jorge Isaac's novels. So just the fact that they appear and again makes them omnipresent figures of transportation in the 19th century. And they were very important. And So this is not like, the fact that they appear again and again allows the possibility of, at least based on the small fragments about how they sounded, to try to speculate not only on how they sounded, which is not what interests me so much. That is, I was not so much interested in reconstructing a genre or a musical mode of sounding that I could trace to the Bogas, or I do a paragraph there in which I analyze the possible characteristics. I was more interested in the process of, let's say, interpretation that happens, as you say, between the ear and the vocal pronunciation. And so what that chapter explores is, on the one hand, the way howlings, which is how they were described as howling, appear in the colonial archive, and the role of howling in establishing the centrality of pitch as a limit of pitch in 19th century comparative musicology. But on the other hand, I also speculate on what does it mean to sound like an animal when you don't have an ontology where, let's say, being an animal is associated to a lesser form of being. So that chapter contrasts two possible forms or two ways of addressing a very differential mode of relating the human and non-human as it appears in the voice.
So in the chapter on songs, and you mentioned Candelario Obeso just a minute ago, and I want to talk a little bit more about him. A chapter on songs has to do with the relationship between the written and the oral versions of songs, and that's really something that is a thread that runs through the entire book, this notion of inscription of sound. And one writer, Candelario Obeso in particular, did something that seems quite radical at the time. It might even seem radical today, which is that he transcribed poetry so that it approximated accent and pronunciation on the page, right? And was this actually radical, and why was it so radical, and what were the politics of a text like that?
Yes, thank you, Alejandra. I think it was very radical, basically because as we know, this problem of inscription of a certain Afro-descendant voice became later a very strong mark of the Negritude movement. What is interesting about Candelario Obeso, he's, you know, second half of the 19th century, and just at that moment, other philologists are theorizing about the relationship between a form of pronunciation and singing, and the creation of a canonic idea about regional song. And the chapter begins with that. And by assigning a certain idea of custom and folklore, let's say, which is the term used later, to different regions and from Colombia. And what Candelario Obeso does is completely different, is in a way challenge the circumscription of a form of pronunciation of the Caribbean into typicality, and rather trying to show a singularity. Moreover, I think the technique for transcribing that he had at hand was the written word, as many others in the 19th century. And what is particularly special about him is how one can see the very sophistication of his mode of listening in the way he transcribes. These poems are not meant to be read. They're meant to be read silently. They're meant to be read out loud. And he gives very detailed instructions as to how to do that. So I think one of the particularities of Candelario Obeso is that he cannot be subsumed easily, either under the search for a, let's say, a costumbrismo, or a figure that can be understood as, you know, sort of hybridizing everything. I think as a very particular figure that had an acuity of listening that was exceptional. And therefore, his mode of transcription is very highlighted. He's also a tremendous translator. So it seems to me that this work on translation and then transduction of the ear, from the ear to writing, sort of coalesces in his work in very particular ways.
So another kind of text that receives a lot of attention is the grammars and the dictionaries of indigenous languages produced by missionaries. And I was struck by the attention given to those grammars in the 19th century, right, by people of such different political orientations. And in that chapter, you have these two really, really fascinating figures, who are really on the opposite sides of these political spectrums. And in the middle of the really volatile late 19th century moments in Colombian history, it's striking that they're taking time off to do these grammars and to edit them. And so you argue in some ways that what's at stake in that production of those texts is the very definition of personhood and non-personhood. So I wonder if you can expand on that argument a little bit.
Yes. There's very different approximations, but I compare mainly Ezequiel Uricochea, who's a very interesting figure, a philologist of the late 19th century, comparative philologist. He came back to Colombia for 10 years and he has a wider formation, as is typical in the time, in cartography and mineralogy and other areas. And he returns to France and later Belgium. And he wants to participate in the comparative philological project by putting American Indian languages on the map. So what he does is he begins a collection in Paris called the Linguistic American Collection, Collection Linguistique Americaine. In that collection, what he does is that he re-edits the missionary grammars with a long introduction by him, in which he speculates or theorizes on the place of such grammars in the comparative linguistic project. And he does that type of project, which is very, very different from the obsession of other grammarians that are in Colombia for a correct Spanish. So he puts on the map a project that is very, very different from that of others, and attends to that in a way, because for him, he's trying to turn the study of missionary grammars into a valid project. Whereas up to then, and even then in the 19th century, for the Colombian grammarians who had stayed in Colombia, the missionary grammars are only for the purpose of conversion. So I think what Uricochea and Isaacs do in their own ways is try to change the study of these languages from a politics of conversion to a nationalistic humanism, which is still very pervaded by theological concerns, but they're not exactly the same. In any case, they're so much not exactly the same that one of the major attacks against Jorge Isaacs, who publishes at the end of his life, towards the end of his life, a study on the indigenous tribes of the Magdalena River, it's what he calls it. It's much more than a grammar. It's also a geography and history book in which he challenges the priestly authority of the chronicles. And by that token, then gains the attack of the main grammarians in Colombia. So in a way, it's a transformation from colonial modes of humanism permeated by a type of religious ethos to the political theology of the nation state. So it's very fraught. The projects are very contradictory, but I think those arguments were used, or those polemics were used to, especially by Caro, who was also writing the Constitution, to reinstate juridically the non-personhood status of the indigenous peoples in the Constitution. They didn't speak properly, and since they didn't speak properly, then they did not merit the national status of other people in the Republic. So it goes to show how, you know, the idea of personhood has this political element that is crisscrossed by, you know, the notions of the voice and its modes of inscription and the very notion of voice that one uses. What is voice for?
Is that related to what you call vocal immunity? I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about that term and how it plays into notions of humanity and personhood.
To a certain extent it is, but that chapter centers on something different, which is basically the distinction between, it's a critique of the distinction between orality, O-R-A-L-I-T-Y, and the written word. And how that distinction ultimately used the idea of the sounding voice, orality, to negate its very presence, because the very concept of orality is based on written notions of how the voice should sound rather than on actual soundings of the voice. So that's what the notion of immunity invokes. It's using, let's say, the same material in order to sort of inoculate and what that material does and is supposed to be. So it's sort of a taming of the material into proper use. And what I talk about in that final chapter is something that has been discussed more widely, at least in Colombia, which is this obsession with a proper pronunciation and a proper use of language as instilled through pedagogical institutions and governmental institutions, which in Colombia was very powerful because a lot of there were grammarian precedents who could institute this through public schools, the church, and the institutions of government. And I also talk about how there's a eugenesis of heritage in which in the search, the philological search for the proper popular term, what you have is the installation of sort of a genealogical search for a term that sort of cleans out the term from its bad heritage. And in that, they sort of develop a method for researching about popular culture. That gives rise to the notion of patrimony. So I explore then sort of that orality is not so much the opposite of the written word as a type of enunciation that subsumes the notion of how things should sound and how popular culture should be collected, or folklore, lo popular in Latin America, under the aegis of a written grammatical ethos. Does that help?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. And,
it struck me as you were talking that one of the things that people say about Colombian Spanish is how beautiful and clear it is. And I often say that because I find that it's true. And it somehow you've opened up this whole world of historicizing that fact. I don't know if that's what you were trying to do, but...
Yes, other scholars have worked on that too, which I, I cite them in the book frequently. So it's not it's a project begun by other people, but I think what I center in is on the problem of orality. I think a lot of people have worked on the obsession of the grammarians with correct speaking, and what I wanted to especially draw attention to is how that correct speaking was applied not only to, let's say, an educational or institutional project of government, but it was applied also to a form of research around folklore and popular culture. So that's more specific, and that's, I think, my specific contribution. But yes, it's the national myth.
So you've talked about this a little bit, but I'm wondering if the book in general, and I took it to mean a lot of different things for a lot of different kinds of questions, and I was really entranced by the methodology in particular, but I'm wondering if you think that this is a book that are the arguments are really specific to Colombia, or if you thought about it more as a kind of calling for a reframing of the methods through which we study the kinds of boundaries of race and status and personhood more generally.
Well, the book didn't begin as a Colombian project specifically. I think initially the book, the idea for the book emerged out of a comparison of modes of production and writing about music in Latin America, know, Andrade, Carpentier, etc. And I wrote one article about that and then moved on to only handling a Colombian archive because I think I wanted to get into the minutia and because I started finding all these things about the voice and about nature and culture. So I think what the book does at this point is the book, I don't think it uses a Colombian archive, but I think it's a book that's significant to think with about the Latin America and the Caribbean in general. Because what it does is it embeds the problem of listening and sounding voices in a 19th century problematic that was common to the whole region, which was what to do with diversity of peoples in the emerging nation states and what to do with the diversity of nature in the moment when that becomes the commercial enterprise. So this book stands at the crossroads of how sounding and, let's say more broadly, a sensorial element was used to administer the definition and the conceptualization of what nature was going to be and what peoplehood and personhood and the relation between the non-human and human was going to be established. So I think that now that this idea of, you know, exploring Latin America from the metaphors of sound has, let's say, grown into maturity, I think this book provides a basis for thinking about that and about thinking about its acoustic dimensions. I think one of the things I want to bring in is also, which is perhaps more evident for people coming from music departments than from literature or Spanish and Portuguese, is that the book also challenges certain histories of the formation of musical thought, but in particular, something which is usually touted as a landmark, which is the separation of music and language, of theory of language and theory of music in the 18th century into distinct fields. And that separation occurs through something which has been given the name of the musical work, which Lydia Gur, the philosopher and musicologist, put on the map. So what I'm arguing, and other scholars as well, so what I'm arguing is that separation did not happen in the same way in Latin America. And as such, the very notion of aurality, which also Jonathan Stern links to a transformation in thinking about orality or an overcoming of orality in the 19th century, generates aurality. And so what I'm saying is that those two forms of autonomy, music from language and, let's say, technological investments on the ear and clinical investments on the ear in the 19th century, as well as were separated from linguistic investments on the voice and pronunciation, did not happen in Latin America and the Caribbean the same way. So it gives for a different philosophical history and anthropological history of the voice and of hearing and of categories of sound and musical description and of modes of production of musical thought, and, you know, which do not necessarily separate language, music, sound, musical work in the same way.
I think that you're also, in a way, proposing a reframing of 19th century history in general, as you say, because the problematic was so much about what do we do with this diversity and how do we contain it or manage it or make it go away somehow, right?
Well, thank you very much for suggesting that. I think rather that what is interesting is that something like the voice and practices of hearing were fundamental to understanding how that organization of diversity, that administration of the different, of the heterogeneity, took place. So perhaps what's new to the book, in the midst of a lot of rewriting about what the 19th century was about or the 18th century was about, is I think the positioning of those two elements, this relationship between listening, voice, and theorizing about that relationship through technology, the recording technology available at the time, which was writing. But, you know, and several entry points into this problem of inscription. So that I think exploring those different entry points gives us different materials and possibilities of interpretation that can, let's say, complement a lot of very creative work that is being done on rethinking history of Latin America.
Right. So we've taken up a lot of your time already, and I wonder if we can just close by you telling us a little bit about your next project. What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm working on correcting the translation of the book. So it will hopefully come out soon in Spanish or sometime next year. So that's my major endeavor right now. I have other ideas, but they're not, you know, some of them are just articles left over from having worked on the book and that I want to coalesce and bring together, but they're too loose right now to formulate fully. So I'm just leaving an open end for now. The book took a long time to research. I have a lot of other materials that I didn't use more in the 20th century than in the 19th century. But there's also new things that are coming up. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm not sure where to go, except first I have to finish the translation.
Which is an important project in and of itself. I think that it's really nice to see the translation of books like this and the way that that happens more and more often. So I'm glad that it's going to be coming out in Spanish as well.
Okay, well, thank you, Alejandra, for inviting me.
Thanks so much for speaking with me today. I really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Latin American Studies. See you next time.